Books on Tape presents The Confessor by Daniel Silva, read by John Lee. Roma locuta est, causa finita est. Rome has spoken. The case is closed. St. Augustine of Hippo. Part 1. An Apartment in Munich. Chapter 1. Munich. The apartment house at Adalbertstrasse 68 was one of the few in the fashionable district of Schwabing yet to be overrun by Munich's noisy and growing professional elite. Wedged between two red brick buildings that exuded pre-war charm, number 68 seemed rather like an ugly younger stepsister. Her facade was a cracked beige stucco, her form squat and graceless. As a result, her suitors were a tenuous community of students, artists, anarchists, and unrepentant punk rockers, all presided over by an authoritarian caretaker named Frau Ratzinger, who, it was rumored, had been living in the original apartment house at number 68 when it was leveled by an Allied bomb. Neighborhood activists derided the building as an eyesore in need of gentrification. Defenders said it exemplified the very sort of bohemian arrogance that had once made Schwabing the Montmartre of Germany, the Schwabing of Hesse and Mann and Lenin. And Adolf Hitler, the professor working in the second-floor window, might have been tempted to add, but few in the old neighborhood liked to be reminded of the fact that the young Austrian outcast had once found inspiration in these quiet tree-lined streets, too. To his students and colleagues, he was Herr Dr. Professor Stern. To friends in the neighborhood, he was just Benjamin. To the occasional visitor from home, he was Binyamin. In an anonymous stone-and-glass office complex in the north of Tel Aviv, where a file of his youthful exploits still resided, despite his pleas to have it burned, he would always be known as Benny, youngest of Ari Shamron's wayward sons. Officially, Benjamin Stern remained a member of the faculty at Hebrew University in Jerusalem, though for the past 4 years he had served as visiting professor of European studies at Munich's prestigious Ludwig Maximilian University. It had become something of a permanent loan, which was fine with Professor Stern. In an odd twist of historical fate, life was more pleasant for a Jew these days in Germany than in Jerusalem or Tel Aviv. The fact that his mother had survived the horrors of the Riga ghetto gave Professor Stern a certain dubious standing among the other tenants of number 68. He was a curiosity. He was their conscience. They railed at him about the plight of the Palestinians. They gently asked him questions they dared not put to their parents and grandparents. He was their guidance counselor and trusted sage. They came to him for advice on their studies. They poured out their heart to him when they'd been dumped by a lover. They raided his fridge when they were hungry, and pillaged his wallet when they were broke. Most importantly, he served as tenant spokesman in all disputes involving the dreaded Frau Ratzinger. Professor Stern was the only one in the building who did not fear her. They seemed to have a special relationship, a kinship. "It's Stockholm Syndrome," claimed Alex, a psychology student who lived on the top floor, prisoner and camp guard, master and servant. But it was more than that. The professor and the old woman seemed to speak the same language. The previous year, when his book on the Wannsee Conference had become an international bestseller, Professor Stern had flirted with the idea of moving to a more stylish building, perhaps one with proper security and a view of the English gardens, a place where the other tenants didn't treat his flat as if it were an annex to their own. This had incited panic among the others. One evening they came to him en masse and petitioned him to stay. Promises were made. They would not steal his food, nor would they ask for loans when there was no hope of repayment. They would be more respectful of his need for quiet. They would come to him for advice only when it was absolutely necessary. The professor acquiesced, but within a month his flat was once again the de facto common room of Adalbertstrasse 68. Secretly, he was glad they were back. The rebellious children of number 68 were the only family Benjamin Stern had left. The clatter of a passing streetcar broke his concentration. He looked up in time to see it disappear behind the canopy of a chestnut tree. then glanced at his watch. 11:30. He'd been at it since 5 that morning. He removed his glasses and spent a long moment rubbing his eyes. What was it Orwell had said about writing a book? A horrible, exhausting struggle like a long bout of some painful illness. Sometimes Benjamin Stern felt as though this book might be fatal. The red light on his telephone answering machine was blinking. He made a habit of muting the ringers to avoid unwanted interruptions. Hesitantly, like a bomb handler deciding which wire to cut, he reached out and pressed the button. The little speaker emitted a blast of heavy metal music, followed by a warlike yelp. "I have some good news, Herr Dr. Professor. By the end of the day, there will be one less filthy Jew on the planet. Wiedersehen, Herr Dr. Professor." Click. Professor Stern erased the message. He was used to them by now. He received 2 a week these days, sometimes more, depending on whether he had made an appearance on television or taken part in some public debate. He knew them by voice, assigned each a trivial, unthreatening nickname to lessen their impact on his nerves. This fellow called at least twice each month. Professor Stern had dubbed him Wolfie. Sometimes he told the police. Most of the time he didn't bother. There was nothing they could do anyway. He locked his manuscript and notes in the floor safe, tucked beneath his desk. Then he pulled on a pair of shoes and a woolen jacket, and collected the rubbish bag from the kitchen. The old building had no elevator, which meant he had to walk down 2 flights of stairs to reach the ground floor. As he entered the lobby, a chemical stench greeted him. The building was home to a small but thriving Kosmetik. The professor detested the beauty shop. When it was busy, the rancid smell of nail polish remover rose through the ventilation system and enveloped his flat. It also made the building less secure than he would have preferred. Because the Kosmetik had no separate street entrance, the lobby was constantly cluttered with beautiful Schwabinians arriving for their pedicures, facials, and waxing. He turned right toward a doorway that gave on to the tiny courtyard, and hesitated in the threshold, checking to see if the cats were about. Last night he'd been awakened at midnight by a skirmish over some morsel of garbage. There were no cats this morning, only a pair of bored beauticians in spotless white tunics smoking cigarettes against the wall. He padded across the sooty bricks and tossed his bag into the bin. Returning to the entrance hall, he found Frau Ratzinger punishing the linoleum floor with a worn straw broom.
"Good morning, Herr Dr. Professor,"
the old woman snapped. Then she added accusingly, "Going out for your morning coffee?" Professor Stern nodded and murmured, "Ja, ja, Frau Ratzinger." She glared at 2 messy stacks of flyers, one advertising a free concert in the park, the other a holistic massage clinic on the Schellingstrasse.
"No matter how many times I ask them not to leave these things here, they do it anyway. It's that drama student in 4B. He lets anyone into the building."
The professor shrugged his shoulders as if mystified by the lawless ways of the young, and smiled kindly at the old woman. Frau Ratzinger picked up the flyers and marched them into the courtyard. A moment later he could hear her berating the beauticians for tossing their cigarette butts on the ground. He stepped outside and paused to take stock of the weather. Not too cold for early March, the sun peering through a gauzy layer of cloud. He pushed his hands into his coat pockets and set out. Entering the English gardens, he followed a tree-lined path along the banks of a rain-swollen canal. He liked the park. It gave his mind a quiet place to rest after the morning's exertions on the computer. More importantly, it gave him an opportunity to see if today they were following him. He stopped walking and beat his coat pockets dramatically to indicate he had forgotten something. Then he doubled back and retraced his steps, scanning faces, checking to see if they matched any of the ones stored in the database of his prodigious memory. He paused on a humpbacked footbridge, as if admiring the rush of the water over a short fall. A drug dealer with spiders tattooed on his face offered him heroin. The professor mumbled something incoherent and walked quickly away. 2 minutes later, he ducked into a public telephone and pretended to place a call, while carefully surveying the surroundings. He hung up the receiver.
"Wiedersehen, Herr Dr. Professor."
He turned on to the Ludwigstrasse and hurried across the university district, head down, hoping to avoid being spotted by any students or colleagues. Earlier that week, He had received a rather nasty letter from Dr. Helmut Berger, the pompous chairman of his department, wondering when the book might be finished, and when he could be expected to resume his lecturing obligations. Professor Stern did not like Helmut Berger. Their well-publicized feud was both personal and academic, and conveniently he had not found the time to respond. The bustle of the Viktualienmarkt pushed thoughts of work from his head. He moved past mounds of brightly colored fruit and vegetables, past flower stalls and open-air butchers. He picked out a few things for his supper, then crossed the street to Café Bar Edusko for coffee and a Dinkelbrot. 45 minutes later, as he set out for Schwabing, he felt refreshed, his mind light, ready for one more wrestling match with his book, his illness, as Orwell would have called it. As he arrived at the apartment house, a gust of wind chased him into the lobby and scattered a fresh stack of salmon-colored flyers. The professor twisted his head so he could read one. A new curry takeaway had opened around the corner. He liked a good curry. He scooped up one of the flyers and stuffed it into his coat pocket. The wind had carried a few of the leaflets toward the courtyard. Frau Ratzinger would be furious. As he trod softly up the stairs, she poked her head from her foxhole of a flat and spotted the mess. Predictably appalled, she glared at him with inquisitor's eyes. Slipping the key into his door lock, he could hear the old woman cursing as she dealt with this latest outrage. In the kitchen, he put away the food and brewed himself a cup of tea. Then he walked down the hallway to his study. A man was standing at his desk, casually leafing through a stack of research. He wore a white tunic, like the ones worn by the beauticians at the Cosmétique, and was very tall with athletic shoulders. His hair was blonde and streaked with grey. Hearing the professor enter the room, the intruder looked up. His eyes were grey, too, cold as a glacier. "Open the safe, Herr Doctor Professor." The voice was calm, almost flirtatious. The German was accented. It wasn't Wulfi. Professor Stern was sure of that. He had a flair for languages and an ear for local dialects. The man in the tunic was Swiss, and his Schweizerdeutsch had the broad sing-song accent of a man from the mountain valleys. "Who in the hell do you think you are?" "Open the safe," the intruder repeated as the eyes returned to the papers on the desk. "There's nothing in the safe of any value. If it's money, you're..." Professor Stern wasn't permitted to finish the sentence. In a swift motion, the intruder reached beneath the tunic, produced a silenced handgun. The professor knew weapons as well as accents. The gun was a Russian-made Stechkin. The bullet tore through the professor's right kneecap. He fell to the floor, hands clutching the wound, blood pumping between his fingers. "I suppose you'll just have to give me the combination now," the Swiss said calmly. The pain was like nothing Benjamin Stern had ever experienced. He was panting, struggling to catch his breath, his mind a maelstrom. The combination? God, but he could barely remember his name. "I'm waiting, Herr Dr. Professor." He forced himself to take a series of deep breaths. This supplied his brain with enough oxygen to permit him to access the combination to the safe. He recited the numbers, his jaw trembling with shock. The intruder knelt in front of the safe and deftly worked the tumbler. A moment later, the door swung open. The intruder looked inside, then at the professor. "You have backup disks. Where do you keep them?"
"I don't know what you're talking about."
"As it stands right now, you'll be able to walk with the use of a cane." He raised the gun. "If I shoot you in the other knee, you'll spend the rest of your life on crutches." The professor was slipping from consciousness. His jaw was trembling.
"Don't shiver, damn you. Don't give him the pleasure of seeing your fear."
"In the refrigerator."
"The refrigerator?"
"In case..."
A burst of pain shot through him.
"Of a fire."
The intruder raised an eyebrow. Clever boy. He'd brought a bag along with him, a black nylon duffel about 3 feet in length. He reached inside and withdrew a cylindrical object, a can of spray paint. He removed the cap, and with a skilled hand, he began to paint symbols on the wall of the study. Symbols of violence, symbols of hate. Ludicrously, the professor found himself wondering what Frau Ratzinger would say when she saw this.
In his delirium he must have murmured something aloud, because the intruder paused for a moment to examine him with a vacant stare. When he was finished with his graffiti, the intruder returned the spray can to his duffel, then stood over the professor. The pain from the shattered bones was making Benjamin stare hot with fever. Blackness was closing in at the edges of his vision, so that the intruder seemed to be standing at the end of a tunnel. The professor searched the ashen eyes for some sign of lunacy, but he found nothing at all but cool intelligence. This man was no racist fanatic, he thought. He was a professional. The intruder stooped over him. "Would you like to make a last confession, Professor Stern?"
"What are you,"
he grimaced in pain,
"talking about?"
"It's very simple. Do you wish to confess your sins?"
"You're the murderer,"
Benjamin Stern said deliriously. The assassin smiled. The gun swung up again, and he fired two shots into the professor's chest. Benjamin Stern felt his body convulse, but was spared further pain. He remained conscious for a few seconds, long enough to see his killer kneel down at his side, and to feel the cool touch of his thumb against his damp forehead. He was mumbling something.
Latin?
Yes, the professor was certain of it.
Ego te absolvo a peccatis tuis, in nomine Patris et Filii et Spiritus Sancti.
Amen. The professor looked into his killer's eyes.
"But I'm a Jew," he murmured.
"It doesn't matter,"
the assassin said. Then he placed the Stetchkin against the side of Benjamin Stern's head and fired one last shot. Chapter 2. Vatican City. 400 miles to the south, on a hillside in the heart of Rome, an old man strolled through the cold shadows of a walled garden, dressed in an ivory cassock and cloak. At 72 years of age he no longer moved quickly, though he came to the gardens each morning and made a point of walking for at least an hour along the pine-scented footpaths. Some of his predecessors had cleared the gardens so they could meditate undisturbed. The man in the ivory cassock liked to see people, real people, not just the fawning curial cardinals and foreign dignitaries who came to kiss his fisherman's ring each day. A Swiss guard always hovered a few paces behind him, more for company than protection, and he enjoyed stopping for a brief chat with the Vatican gardeners. He was a naturally curious man and considered himself something of a botanist. Occasionally he borrowed a pair of pruning shears and helped trim the roses. Once a Swiss guard had found him on his hands and knees in the garden. Assuming the worst, the guard had summoned an ambulance and rushed to his side, only to find that the supreme pontiff of the Roman Catholic Church had decided to do a bit of weeding. Those closest to the Holy Father could see that something was troubling him. He had lost much of the good humor and easy charm that had seemed like a breath of spring breeze after the dour final days of the pole. Sister Teresa, the iron-willed nun from Venice who ran his papal household, had noticed a distinct loss of appetite. Even the sweet biscotti she left with his afternoon coffee went untouched lately. She often entered the papal study on the third floor of the Apostolic Palace and found him lying face down on the floor, deep in prayer, eyes closed as though he were in agony. Karl Brunner, the head of his Swiss guard detail, had noticed the Holy Father frequently standing at the Vatican walls, gazing across the Tiber, seemingly lost in thought. Brunner had protected the Pole for many years, and had seen the toll the papacy had taken on him. It was part of the job, he counseled Sister Teresa, the crushing burden of responsibility that falls on every pope. It is enough to make even the holiest of men lose their temper from time to time. I'm certain God will give him the strength to overcome it. The old Pietro will be back soon. Sister Teresa was not so sure. She was among the handful of people inside the Vatican who knew how much Pietro Lucchesi had not wanted this job. When he had arrived in Rome for the funeral of John Paul II and the conclave that would choose his successor, the elfin, soft-spoken patriarch of Venice was not considered remotely papabile, a man possessed with the qualities necessary to be pope, nor did he give even the slightest indication that he was interested. The 15 years he had spent working in the Roman Curia were the unhappiest of his career, and he had no desire to return to the backbiting village on the Tiber, even as its Lord High. Lucchese had intended to cast his vote for the Archbishop of Buenos Aires, whom he had befriended during a tour of Latin America, and return quietly to Venice. But inside the conclave things did not go as intended. As their predecessors had done time and time again over the centuries, Lucchese and his fellow princes of the church, 130 in all, entered the Sistine Chapel in solemn procession, while singing the Latin hymn Veni Creator Spiritus. They gathered beneath Michelangelo's Last Judgment, with its humbling depiction of tormented souls rising toward heaven to face the wrath of Christ, and prayed for the Holy Spirit to guide their hand. Then each cardinal stepped forward individually, placed his hand atop the Holy Gospels, and swore an oath binding him to irrevocable silence. When this task was complete, the master of papal liturgical ceremonies commanded, Extra omnes, everyone out, and the conclave began in earnest. The Pole had not been content to leave matters solely in the hands of the Holy Spirit. He had stacked the College of Cardinals with prelates like himself, doctrinaire hardliners, determined to preserve ecclesiastical discipline and the power of Rome over all else. Their candidate was an Italian, a consummate creature of the Roman Curia, Cardinal Secretary of State Marco Brindisi. The moderates had other ideas. They pleaded for a truly pastoral papacy. They wanted the occupant of the throne of St. Peter to be a gentle and pious man, a man who would be willing to share power with the bishops and limit the influence of the Curia, a man who could reach across the lines of geography and faith to heal those corners of the globe torn by war and poverty. Only a non-European was suitable to the moderates. They believed the time had come for a third world pope. The first ballots revealed the conclave to be hopelessly divided, and soon both factions were searching for a way out of the impasse. On the final ballot of the day, a new name surfaced. Pietro Lucchese, the Patriarch of Venice, received 5 votes. Hearing his name read 5 times inside the sacred chamber of the Sistine Chapel, Lucchese closed his eyes and blanched visibly. A moment later, when the ballots were placed into the Nero for burning, several cardinals noticed that Lucchese was praying. That evening, Pietro Lucchese politely refused an invitation to dine with a group of fellow cardinals, adjourning to his room at the dormitory of St. Martha instead, to meditate and pray. He knew how conclaves worked and could see what was coming. Like Christ in the Garden of Gethsemane, he pleaded with God to lift this burden from his shoulders, to choose someone else. But the following morning, Lucchese's support built, rising steadily toward the 2/3 majority necessary to be elected pope. On the final ballot taken before lunch, he was just 10 votes short. Too anxious to take food, he prayed in his room before returning to the Sistine Chapel for the ballot that he knew would make him pope. He watched silently as each cardinal advanced and placed a twice-folded slip of paper into the golden chalice that served as a ballot box, each uttering the same solemn oath, I call as my witness Christ the Lord, who will be my judge, that my vote is given to the one whom before God I think should be elected. The ballots were checked and rechecked before the tally was announced. 115 votes had been cast for Lucchese. The Camerlengo approached Lucchese and posed the same question that had been put to hundreds of newly elected popes over 2 millennia. Do you accept your canonical election as supreme pontiff? After a lengthy silence that produced much tension in the chapel, Pietro Lucchese responded, My shoulders are not broad enough to bear the burden you have given me, but with the help of Christ the Saviour, I will try. Accepto. By what name do you wish to be called? Paul VII, Lucchese replied. The cardinals filed forward to embrace the new pontiff and offer obedience and loyalty to him. Lucchese was then escorted to the scarlet chamber known as the Camera Lacrimatoria, the crying room, for a few minutes of solitude, before being fitted with a white cassock by the Gamarelli brothers, the pontifical tailors. He chose the smallest of the 3 ready-made cassocks, and even then he seemed like a small boy wearing his father's shirt. As he filed onto the great loggia of St. Peter's to greet Rome and the world, His head was barely visible above the balustrade. A Swiss guard brought forth a footstool, and a great roar rose from the stunned crowd in the square below. A commentator for Italian television breathlessly declared the new pope Pietro the Improbable. Cardinal Marco Brindisi, the head of the hard-line curial cardinals, privately christened him Pope Accidental the First. The Vaticanisti said the message of the divisive conclave was clear. Pietro Lucchesi was a compromise pope. His mandate was to run the church in a competent fashion but launch no grand initiatives. The battle for the heart and soul of the church, said the Vaticanisti, had effectively been postponed for another day. But Catholic reactionaries, religious and lay alike, did not take such a benign view of Lucchesi's election. To militants, the new pope bore an uncomfortable resemblance to a tubby Venetian named Roncalli, who'd inflicted the doctrinal calamity of the Second Vatican Council. Within hours of the conclave's conclusion, the websites and cyber-confessionals of the hardliners were bristling with warnings and dire predictions about what lay ahead. Lucchesi's sermons and public statements were scoured for evidence of unorthodoxy. The reactionaries did not like what they discovered. Lucchesi was trouble, they concluded. Lucchesi would have to be kept under watch, tightly scripted. It would be up to the mandarins of the Curia to make certain Pietro Lucchesi became nothing more than a caretaker pope. But Lucchesi believed there were far too many problems confronting the church for a papacy to be wasted, even the papacy of an unwilling pope. The church he inherited from the Pole was a church in crisis. In Western Europe, the epicenter of Catholicism, the situation had grown so dire that a recent synod of bishops declared that Europeans were living as though God did not exist. Fewer babies were being baptized, fewer couples were choosing to be married in the church. Vocations had plummeted to a point where nearly half the parishes in Western Europe would soon have no full-time priest. Lucchesi had to look no further than his own diocese to see the problems the church faced. 70% of Rome's 2.5 million Catholics believed in divorce, birth control, and premarital sex, all officially forbidden by the church. Fewer than 10% bothered to attend Mass on a regular basis. In France, the so-called first daughter of the church, the statistics were even worse. In North America, most Catholics didn't even bother to read his encyclicals before flouting them, and only a third attended Mass. 70% of Catholics lived in the Third World, yet most of them rarely saw a priest. In Brazil alone, 600,000 people left the church each year to become evangelical Protestants. Lucchesi wanted to stem the bleeding before it was too late. He longed to make his beloved church more relevant in the lives of its adherents, to make his flock Catholic in more than name only. But there was something else that had preoccupied him, a single question that had run ceaselessly around his head since the moment the conclave elected him pope. Why? Why had the Holy Spirit chosen him to lead the church? What special gift, what sliver of knowledge did he possess that made him the right pontiff for this moment in history? Lucchesi believed he knew the answer, and he had set in motion a perilous stratagem that would shake the Roman Catholic Church to its foundations. If his gambit proved successful, it would revolutionize the church. If it failed, it might very well destroy it. The sun slipped behind a bank of cloud, and a breath of cold March wind stirred the pine trees of the garden. The pope pulled his cloak tightly around his throat. He drifted past the Ethiopian college, then turned onto a narrow footpath that took him toward the dun-colored wall at the southwest corner of Vatican City. Stopping at the foot of the Vatican radio tower, he mounted a flight of stone steps and climbed up to the parapet. Rome lay before him, stirring in the flat, overcast light. His gaze was drawn across the Tiber, toward the soaring synagogue in the heart of the old ghetto. In 1555, Pope Paul IV, a pope whose name Lucchesi bore, ordered the Jews of Rome into the ghetto and compelled them to wear a yellow star to make them distinguishable from Christians. It was the intention of those who commissioned the synagogue to build it tall enough so that it would be seen from the Vatican. The message was unmistakably clear. We are here, too. Indeed, we were here long before you. For Pietro Lucchesi, the synagogue spoke of something else, a treacherous past, a shameful secret. It spoke directly to him, whispering into his ear. It would give him no peace. The Pope heard footfalls on the garden pathway, sharp and rhythmic, like an expert carpenter driving nails. He turned and saw a man marching toward the wall. Tall and lean, black hair, black clerical suit, a vertical line drawn with India ink. Father Luigi Donati, the Pope's private secretary. Donati had been at Lucchese's side for 20 years. In Venice they had called him Il Doge, because of his willingness to wield power ruthlessly and to go straight for the throat when it served his purposes or the needs of his master. The nickname had followed him to the Vatican. Donati did not mind. He followed the tenets of a secular Italian philosopher named Machiavelli, who counseled that it is better for a prince to be feared than loved. Every pope needed a son of a bitch, according to Donati, a hard man in black who was willing to take on the curia with a whip and a chair and bend it to his will. It was a role he played with poorly disguised glee. As Donati drew closer to the parapet, the Pope could see by the grim set of his jaw that something was wrong. He turned his gaze toward the river once more and waited. A moment later he could feel the reassuring presence of Donati at his side. As usual, Il Doge wasted no time on pleasantries or small talk. He leaned close to the Pope's ear and quietly informed him that earlier that morning Professor Benjamin Stern had been discovered murdered in his apartment in Munich. The Pope closed his eyes and lowered his chin to his chest, then reached out and held Father Donati's hand tightly. "How?" he asked. "How did they kill him?" When Father Donati told him, the Pope swayed and leaned against the priest's arm for support. "Almighty God in heaven, please grant us forgiveness for what we have done." Then he looked into the eyes of his trusted secretary. Father Donati's gaze was calm and intelligent and very determined. It gave the Pope the courage to go forward. "I'm afraid we've terribly underestimated our enemies, Luigi. They are more formidable than we thought, and their wickedness knows no bounds. They will stop at nothing to protect their dirty secrets." "Indeed, Holiness," Donati said gravely. "In fact, we must now operate under the assumption that they might even be willing to murder a pope." Murder a pope? It was difficult for Pietro Lucchese to imagine such a thing, but he knew his trusted secretary was not guilty of exaggeration. The church was riddled with a cancer. It had been allowed to fester during the long reign of the Pole. Now it had metastasized and was threatening the life of the very organism in which it lived. It needed to be removed. Aggressive measures were required if the patient was to be saved. The Pope looked away from Donati, toward the dome of the synagogue rising over the riverbank. "I'm afraid there's no one who can do this deed but me." Father Donati placed his hand on the Pope's forearm and squeezed. "Only you can compose the words, Holiness. Leave the rest in my hands." Donati turned and walked away, leaving the Pope alone at the parapet. He listened to the sound of his hard man in black pounding along the footpath toward the palace. Crack, 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 crack. To Pietro Lucchese, it sounded like nails in a coffin. Chapter 3. Venice. The night rains had flooded the Campo San Zaccaria. The restorer stood on the steps of the church like a castaway. In the center of the square, an old priest appeared out of the mist, lifting the skirts of his simple black cassock to reveal a pair of knee-length rubber boots. "It's like the Sea of Galilee this morning, Mario," he said, digging a heavy ring of keys from his pocket. "If only Christ had bestowed on us the ability to walk on water, winters in Venice would be much more tolerable." The heavy wooden door opened with a deep groan. The nave was still in darkness. The priest switched on the lights and headed out into the flooded square once more, pausing briefly in the sanctuary to dip his fingers in holy water and make the sign of the cross. The scaffolding was covered by a shroud. The restorer climbed up to his platform and switched on a fluorescent lamp. The Virgin glowed at him seductively. For much of that winter he had been engaged in a single-minded quest to repair her face. Some nights she came to him in his sleep, stealing into his bedroom, her cheeks in tatters, begging him to heal her. He turned on a portable electric heater to burn the chill from the air, and poured a cup of black coffee from the thermos bottle, enough to make him alert, but not to make his hand shake. Then he prepared his palette, mixing dry pigment in a tiny puddle of medium. When finally he was ready, he lowered his magnifying visor and began to work. For nearly an hour, he had the church to himself. Slowly, the rest of the team trickled in one by one. The restorer, hidden behind his shroud, knew each by sound. The lumbering plod of Francesco Tiepolo, chief of the San Zaccaria project. The crisp tap-tap-tap of Adriana Zanetti, renowned cleaner of altars and seducer of men. The conspiratorial shuffle of the ham-fisted Antonio Politti, spreader of malicious lies and gossip. The restorer was something of an enigma to the rest of the San Zaccaria team. He insisted on keeping his work platform and the altarpiece shrouded at all times. Francesco Tiepolo had pleaded with him to lower the shroud so the tourists and the notoriously bitchy Venetian upper crust could watch him work.
"Venice wants to see what you're doing to the Bellini, Mario. Venice doesn't like surprises."
Reluctantly, the restorer had relented, and for 2 days in January he worked in full view of the tourists and the rest of the Zaccaria team. The brief experiment ended when Monsignor Moretti, San Zaccaria's parish priest, popped into the church for a surprise inspection. When he gazed up at the Bellini and saw half the Virgin's face gone, he fell to his knees in hysterical prayer. The shroud returned, and Francesco Tiepolo never dared to raise the issue of removing it again. The rest of the team found great metaphorical significance in the shroud. Why would a man go to such lengths to conceal himself? Why did he insist on setting himself apart from the others? Why did he decline their numerous invitations to lunch, their invitations to dinner, and to the Saturday night drinking sessions at Harry's bar? He had even refused to attend the cocktail reception at the Accademia, thrown by the Friends of San Zaccaria. The Bellini was one of the most important paintings in all Venice, and it was considered scandalous that he refused to spend a few minutes with the fat American donors who had made the restoration possible. Even Adriana Zanetti could not penetrate the shroud. This gave rise to rampant speculation that the restorer was a homosexual, which was considered no crime among the free spirits of Team Zaccaria, and temporarily increased his sagging popularity among some of the boys. The theory was put to rest one evening when he was met at the church by a stunningly attractive woman. She had wide cheekbones, pale skin, green cat-like eyes, and a teardrop chin. It was Adriana Zanetti who noticed the heavy scarring on her left hand.
"She's his other project," Adriana speculated gloomily, as the pair disappeared into the Venetian night. "Obviously he prefers his women damaged."
He called himself Mario Del Vecchio, but his Italian, while fluent, was tinged by a faint but unmistakable accent. He explained this away by saying he had been raised abroad, and had lived in Italy only for brief periods. Someone heard he had served his apprenticeship with the legendary Umberto Conti. Someone else heard that Conti had proclaimed his hands the most gifted he had ever seen. The envious Antonio Politti was responsible for the next wave of rumors that rippled through Team Zaccaria. Antonio found the leisurely pace of his colleague infuriating. In less time than it had taken the great Mario Del Vecchio to retouch the Virgin's face, Antonio had cleaned and restored a half dozen paintings. The fact that they all were of little or no significance only increased his anger.
"The master himself painted her in an afternoon," Antonio protested to Tiepolo. "But this man has taken all winter, always running off to the Accademia to gaze at the Bellinis. Tell him to get on with it, otherwise we're going to be here 10 years.
It was Antonio who unearthed the rather bizarre story about Vienna, which he shared with the rest of Team Zaccaria during a family dinner one snowy evening in February, coincidentally at Trattoria alla Madonna. About 10 years earlier, there had been a major cleaning and restoration project at St. Stephen's Cathedral in Vienna. An Italian called Mario was part of that team.
"Our Mario?" Adriana wondered over a glass of ripasso.
"Of course it was our Mario. Same snobbery, same snail's pace.
According to Antonio's source, the restorer in question had vanished without a trace one night. The same night, a car bomb exploded in the old Jewish quarter.
And what do you make of this, Antonio?
Again it was Adriana, peering at him through the ruby ripasso. Antonio paused, for dramatic effect, spearing a piece of grilled polenta and holding it aloft, like a scepter.
Isn't it obvious? Clearly the man is a terrorist. I'd say he's Brigate Rossa.
Or maybe he's Osama bin Laden himself.
Team Zakaria erupted into such laughter that they were nearly asked to leave the restaurant. The theories of Antonio Politi were never again given any credence, although he never lost faith in them himself. Secretly, he hoped the quiet restorer behind the shroud would repeat his performance of Vienna and vanish without a trace. Then Antonio would step in and finish the Bellini, and his reputation would be made. The restorer worked well that morning, and the time slipped rapidly away. Glancing at his wristwatch, he was surprised to see that it was already 11:30. He sat down on the edge of the platform, poured more coffee, and looked up at the altarpiece. Painted by Bellini at the height of his powers, it was widely regarded by historians as the first great altarpiece of the 16th century. The restorer never tired of looking at it. He marveled at Bellini's skillful use of light and space, the powerful pulling effect that drew his eye inward and upward, the sculptural nobility of the Madonna and Child and the saints surrounding them. It was a painting of utter silence. Even after a long, tedious morning of work, the painting blanketed him with a sense of peace. He pulled aside the shroud. The sun was out. The nave was filled with light streaming through the stained-glass windows. As he finished the last of his coffee, his attention was drawn by a movement at the entrance of the church. It was a boy, about 10 years old, with long, curly hair. His shoes were soaked from the water in the square. The restorer watched him intently. Even after 10 years, he could not look at a young boy without thinking of his son. The boy went first to Antonio, who waved him on without looking up from his work. Next he made his way up the long center aisle to the high altar, where he received a more friendly reception from Adriana. She smiled at him, touched the side of his face, then pointed in the direction of the restorer's scaffold. The child stopped at the foot of the platform and wordlessly passed the restorer a slip of paper. He unfolded it and found a few words, scrawled like the last plea of a desperate lover. The note was unsigned, but the hand was as plain as the brushstrokes of Bellini. Ghetto Nuovo, 6 o'clock. The restorer crushed the paper and slipped it into his pocket. When he looked down again, the child was gone. At 5:30, Francesco Tiepolo entered the church and lumbered slowly across the nave. With his tangled beard, flowing white shirt, and silk scarf knotted at his throat, the immense Italian looked as though he had just stepped from a Renaissance workshop. It was a look he carefully cultivated.
"All right, everyone," he sang, his voice echoing among the apses and the columns. "That's all for today. Pack up your things. Doors close in 5 minutes."
He seized the restorer's work platform in his bear-like paw and shook it once, violently rattling his lights and brushes.
"You too, Mario. Give your lady a kiss good night. She'll be all right without you for a few hours. She's managed for 500 years.
The restorer methodically wiped off his brushes and palette and packed his pigments and solvents into a rectangular case of varnished wood. Then he switched off the lamp and hopped down from the scaffolding. As always, he left the church without saying a word to the others. With his case beneath his arm, he struck out across the Campo San Zaccaria. He had a smooth gait that seemed to propel him effortlessly across the square, though his unimpressive height and lean physique made him easy to miss. The black hair was cropped short and shot with grey. The angular face, with its deeply cleft chin and full lips, gave the impression of having been carved from wood. The most lasting impression of the face was the eyes, which were almond-shaped, and a shocking shade of emerald green. Despite the demanding nature of his work and the fact that he had recently celebrated his 51st birthday, his vision remained perfect. Passing through an archway, he came to the Riva della Schiavoni, the broad quay overlooking the Canale di San Marco. In spite of the chill March weather, There were many tourists about. The restorer could make out a half-dozen different languages, most of which he could speak. A phrase of Hebrew reached his ears. It diminished quickly, like music on the wind, but left the restorer with an unyielding ache to hear the sound of his real name. A number 82 Vaporetto was waiting at the stop. He boarded and found a place along the railing from which he could see the face of every passenger getting on and off. He dug the note from his pocket and read it one last time. Then he dropped it over the side of the boat and watched it drift away on the silken waters of the lagoon. In the 15th century, a swampy parcel of land in the sestieri of Cannareggio was set aside for the construction of a new brass foundry, known in the Venetian dialect as a ghetto. The foundry was never built, and a century later, when the rulers of Venice were looking for a suitable spot to confine the city's swelling population of unwanted Jews, the remote parcel known as Ghetto Nuovo was deemed the ideal place. The campo was large and had no parish church. The surrounding canals formed a natural moat, which cut off the island from the neighboring communities, and the single bridge could be guarded by Christian watchmen. In 1516, the Christians of Ghetto Nuovo were evicted, and the Jews of Venice were forced to take their place. They could leave the ghetto only after sunrise, when the bell tolled in the campanile, and only if they wore a yellow tunic and hat. At nightfall, they were required to return to the island, and the gates were chained. Only Jewish doctors could leave the ghetto at night. At its height, the population of the ghetto was more than 5,000. Now it was home to only 20 Jews. The restorer crossed a metal footbridge. A ring of apartment buildings, unusually tall for Venice, loomed before him. He entered a sottoportego and followed it beneath the apartment houses, emerging a moment later into a square, the Campo di Ghetto Nuovo. A kosher restaurant, a Jewish bakery, a bookstore, a museum. There were two old synagogues as well, virtually invisible except to a trained eye. Only the five windows on the second story of each, the symbol for the five books of the Pentateuch, gave away their locations. A half-dozen boys were playing football between the long shadows and the puddles. A ball bounced toward the restorer. He gave it a deft kick with the instep of his right foot and sent it expertly back toward the game. One of the boys took it squarely in the chest. It was the one who had come to San Zaccaria that morning. The child nodded in the direction of the pozzo, the wellhead in the center of the square. The restorer turned and saw a familiar figure leaning there, smoking a cigarette. Grey cashmere overcoat, grey scarf wound tightly around his neck, a bullet-shaped head. The skin of his face was deeply tanned and full of cracks and fissures, like desert rock scored by a million years of sun and wind. The spectacles were small and round and inadvertently fashionable. The expression was one of perpetual impatience. As the restorer approached, the old man lifted his head and his lips curled into something between a smile and a grimace. He seized the restorer by the arm and inflicted a bone-crushing handshake. Then, tenderly, he kissed his cheek. "You're here because of Benjamin, aren't you?" The old man closed his crumpled eyelids and nodded. Then he hooked two stubby fingers inside the restorer's elbow and said, "Walk with me." For an instant, the restorer resisted the pull, but there was no escaping it. There had been a death in the family, and Ari Shamron was never one for sitting Shiva. It had been a year since Gabriel had seen him last. Shamron had grown visibly older since that day. As they set off round the campo in the gathering darkness, Gabriel had to resist the urge to take him by the arm. His cheeks had hollowed, and the steel-blue eyes, eyes that had once struck fear into his enemies and his allies alike, were clouded and wet. When he raised his Turkish cigarette to his lips, his right hand trembled. Those hands had made Shamron a legend. Shortly after he joined the office in the 1950s, Shamron's superiors noticed that he possessed an unusually strong grip for a man with such an ordinary physique. He was trained in the art of street snatches and silent killing, and sent into the field. He preferred the garrote, and used it with deadly efficiency from the cobbled streets of Europe to the filthy alleyways of Cairo and Damascus. He killed Arab spies and generals. He killed the Nazi scientists who were helping NASA build rockets. And on a warm night in April 1960, in a town north of Buenos Aires, Ari Shamron leapt from the back of a car and seized Adolf Eichmann by the throat as he was waiting for a bus to take him home. Gabriel was the only person who knew one other salient fact about that night in Argentina. Adolf Eichmann had nearly escaped because Shamron had tripped over a loose shoelace. That same edge of disaster quality would mark his many stopovers in the executive suite at King Saul Boulevard. Prime ministers never knew quite what to expect when Shamron appeared outside their door. Word of another shocking success, or a secret confession of another humiliating failure. His willingness to take risks was both a potent operational strength and a crippling political weakness. Gabriel had lost count of how many times the old man had been cast into exile, then recalled to colors with great fanfare. Shamron's hold on the executive suite had finally been broken, though his exile would never be permanent. He retained the dubious title of Special Administrative Advisor, which gave him just enough entree to make a general nuisance of himself, and from his fortress-like villa overlooking the Sea of Galilee, he still exercised considerable clandestine power. Spies and generals regularly went there to kiss his ring, and no major decision regarding the security of the state could be taken without first running it past the old man. His health was a carefully guarded secret. Gabriel had heard rumors about prostate cancer, a mild heart attack, recurring problems with his kidneys. It was clear the old man didn't have long to live. Shamron did not fear death, only that in his absence would spring complacency. And now, as they ambled slowly around the old ghetto, death walked beside them. Benjamin's death, and Shamron's. The nearness of death had made Shamron restless. He seemed like a man anxious to settle accounts, an old warrior desperate for one last fight. "Did you go to the funeral?" Shamron shook his head.
"Benjamin feared his academic achievements would be tainted if it ever became known he'd worked for us. My presence at the burial would only have raised uncomfortable questions, in Israel and abroad, so I stayed away. I have to admit, I wasn't anxious to attend. It's difficult to bury a child."
"Was anyone there? He had no other family in Israel."
"I'm told there were some old friends from the overt world, and a few members of the faculty from Hebrew."
"Who sent you here?"
"What does it matter?"
"It matters to me. Who sent you?"
"I'm like a parolee," Shamron said wearily. "I cannot move or act without the approval of the Supreme Tribunal."
"And who sits on this tribunal?"
"Lev, for one. Of course, if it were up to Lev, I'd be locked in a room with an iron cot and bread and water. But, fortunately for me, the other person on the tribunal is the Prime Minister."
"Your old comrade in arms."
"Let's just say we share similar opinions about the nature of the conflict and the true intentions of our enemies. We speak the same language and enjoy each other's company. He keeps me in the game, despite Lev's best efforts to wrap me in my burial shroud."
"It's not a game, Ari.
It never was a game." "You don't need to remind me of that, Gabriel. You spend your time here in the playgrounds of Europe, while every day the Shahids are blowing themselves to bits on Ben Yehuda Street and Jaffa Road."
"I work here."
"Forgive me, Gabriel. I didn't mean that to be as harsh as it sounded. What are you working on, by the way?"
"Do you really care?"
"Of course I do. I wouldn't have asked otherwise."
"The Bellini altarpiece in the Church of the San Zaccaria. It's one of the most important paintings in Venice."
Shamron's face broke into a genuine smile.
"I would love to see the look on the patriarch's face if he ever found out that his precious altarpiece was being restored by a nice Jewish boy from the Jezreel Valley."
Without warning, he stopped walking and coughed violently into a handkerchief. When he drew a few deep breaths to steady himself, Gabriel could hear a rattle in his chest. The old man needed to get out of the cold, but he was too stubborn ever to admit physical weakness. Gabriel decided to do it for him. "Do you mind if we sit down someplace? I've been standing on my scaffolding since 8 o'clock this morning." Shamron managed a weary smile. He knew he was being deceived. He led Gabriel to a bakery on the edge of the campo. It was empty except for a tall girl behind the counter. She served them without taking their order. Cups of espresso, small bottles of mineral water, a plate of rugala with cinnamon and nuts. As she leaned over the table, a mane of dark hair fell across the front of one shoulder. Her long hands smelled of vanilla. She covered herself in a bronze-colored wrap and went into the campo, leaving Gabriel and Shamron alone in the shop. Gabriel said, "I'm listening."
"That's an improvement. Usually you start off by yelling at me about how I've ruined your life."
"I'm sure we'll get to that at some point."
"You and my daughter should compare notes."
"We have. How is she?"
"Still living in New Zealand, on a chicken farm, if you can believe that, and still refusing to take my telephone calls."
He took a long time lighting his next cigarette.
"She resents me terribly. Says I was never there for her. What she doesn't understand is that I was busy. I had a people to protect."
"It won't last forever."
"In case you haven't noticed, neither will I."
Shamron took a bite of rugala and chewed it slowly.
"How's Anna?"
"I suppose she's fine. I haven't spoken to her in nearly 2 months."
Shamron lowered his chin and peered disapprovingly at Gabriel over his spectacles.
"Please tell me you didn't break that poor woman's heart."
Gabriel stirred sugar into his coffee and looked away from Shamron's steady stare. Anna Rolf. She was a world-renowned concert violinist and the daughter of a wealthy Swiss banker named Augustus Rolf. A year earlier, Gabriel had helped her track down the men who had murdered her father. Along the way, he had also forced her to confront the unpleasant circumstances about her father's wartime past and the source of his remarkable collection of Impressionist and modern paintings. He had also fallen in love with the tempestuous virtuoso. After the operation, he'd lived for 6 months at her secluded villa on the Sintra coast of Portugal. Their relationship began to crumble when Gabriel confessed to her that each time they strolled the streets of the village, it was the shadow of his wife Leia he saw at his shoulder, and that some nights, while they made love, Leia stood in their bedroom, a silent spectator to their contentment. When Francesco Tiepolo offered him the San Zaccaria altarpiece, Gabriel accepted without hesitation. Anna Rolf did not stand in his way.
"I'm very fond of her, but it would never have worked."
"Did she spend any time with you here in Venice?"
"She performed at the benefit at the Frari. She stayed with me for 2 days. I'm afraid it only made things worse."
Shamron slowly crushed out his cigarette.
"I suppose I'm partly to blame. I pushed you into it before you were ready."
As he always did on occasions such as these, Shamron asked if Gabriel had been to see Leia. Gabriel heard himself say that he had gone to the secluded psychiatric clinic in the south of England before coming to Venice, that he had spent an afternoon with her, pushing her about the grounds, that they had even had a picnic lunch beneath the bare limbs of a maple. But while he spoke, his mind was elsewhere. The tiny street in Vienna, not far from the Judenplatz, the car bomb that killed his son, the inferno that destroyed Leia's body and stole her memory. "It's been 12 years, and she still doesn't recognize me. To be honest with you, sometimes I don't recognize her." Gabriel paused, then said, "But you didn't come here to discuss my personal life."
"No, I didn't," Shamron said. "But your personal life is relevant. You see, if you were still involved with Anna Rolf, I couldn't ask you to come back to work for me. At least not in good conscience." When have you ever let your conscience get in the way of something you wanted? Now there's the old Gabriel that I know and love. Shamron flashed an iron smile. How much do you know about the murder of Benjamin?
Only what I read in the Herald Tribune. The Munich police say he was killed by neo-Nazis.
Shamron snorted. Clearly he did not agree with the findings of the Munich police, no matter how preliminary.
I suppose it's possible. Benjamin's writings on the Holocaust made him extremely unpopular among many segments of German society, and the fact that he was an Israeli made him a target. But I'm not convinced that some skinhead managed to kill him. You see, whenever Jews die on German soil, it makes me uneasy. I want to know more than what the Munich police are telling us on an official basis.
Why don't you send a Katzer to Munich to investigate?
Because if one of our field officers starts asking questions, people are going to get suspicious. Besides, you know that I always prefer the back door to the front.
What do you have in mind?
In 2 days, the Munich detective in charge of the case is going to meet with Benjamin's half-brother, Ehud Landau. After briefing Landau on the investigation, he will allow him to take inventory of Benjamin's possessions and arrange a shipment back to Israel.
If memory serves, Benjamin doesn't have a half-brother.
He does now.
Shamron placed an Israeli passport on the table and slid it toward Gabriel with the palm of his hand. Gabriel opened the cover and saw his own face staring back at him. Then he looked at the name, Ehud Landau.
Shamron said, "You have the best eyes I've ever seen. Have a look around his apartment. See if there's something out of place. If you can, remove anything that might tie him to the office."
Gabriel closed the passport, but left it lying on the table.
"I'm in the middle of a difficult restoration. I can't go running off to Munich now."
"It will take a day, two at the most."
"That's what you said last time."
Shamron's temper, always seething below the surface, broke through. He pounded his fist on the table and shouted at Gabriel in Hebrew,
"Do you wish to fix your silly painting, or help me find out who killed your friend?"
"It's always that simple for you, isn't it?"
"Oh, but I wish it were so. Do you intend to help me, or will you force me to turn to one of Lev's oafs for this delicate—"
Gabriel made a show of contemplation, but his mind was already made up. He scooped up the passport with a smooth movement of his hand and slipped it into his coat pocket. Gabriel had the hands of a conjurer and a magician's sense of misdirection. The passport was there, the passport was gone. Next, Shamron reached into his coat pocket and withdrew a mid-sized manila envelope. Inside, Gabriel found an airline ticket and an expensive Swiss-made wallet of black leather. He opened the wallet. Israeli driver's license, credit cards, membership to an exclusive Tel Aviv health club, a checkout card for a local video store, a substantial amount of currency in euros and shekels.
"What do I do for a living?"
"You own an art gallery. Your business cards are in the zippered compartment."
Gabriel found the cards and removed one. "Landau Art Gallery, Scheinkin Street, Tel Aviv."
"Does it exist?"
"It does now."
The last item in the envelope was a gold wristwatch with a black leather band. Gabriel turned over the watch and read the engraving on the back. "For Ehud, from Hannah, with love."
"Nice touch," Gabriel said.
"I've always found it's the little things."
The watch, the airline tickets, and the wallet joined the passport in Gabriel's pocket. The two men stood. As they walked outside, the long-haired girl in the bronze-colored wrap came quickly to Shamron's side. Gabriel realized she was the old man's bodyguard.
"Where are you going?"
"Back to Tiberias," Shamron replied. "If you pick up something interesting, send it to King Saul Boulevard, through the usual channels."
"Whose eyes?"
"Mine, but that doesn't mean little Lev won't have a peek, so use appropriate discretion."
In the distance, a church bell tolled. Shamron stopped in the center of the campo, next to the pozzo, and took one last look around.
"Our first ghetto. God, how I do hate this place."
It's too bad you weren't in Venice in the 16th century, Gabriel said. The Council of Ten would never have dared to lock the Jews away here.
But I was here, Shamron said with conviction. I was always here, and I remember it all.
This book is continued on Disc 2.